Stephen Mackey, welcome back to St. Louis.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Sometimes when people think of great composers of the past, whether it be Bach, Mozart, Brahms, or Duke Ellington, they don't think that these were artists who were often writing for specific musicians. For instance, Brahms wrote about Joseph Joachim and Clara Schumann. Ellington wrote for Ben Webster and Sonny Greer. You worked closely with Orly Shaham on Stumble to Grace. How did the musician affect the composing of the work?
Well, in the last, especially in the last 10 or so years of my career, it's become more and more important for me to have a specific musician in mind. I mean, as a composer, you're always looking for specificity and particularity, and you want your piece to really have character and to explore new territory. And so collaboration is the way, for me anyway, to help explore new territory, to map somebody else's predilections into mine and see what happens. So in the case of the piano concerto, I heard Orly play live and heard some recordings and really got a sense of what she did well. I think an analogy would be like being a playwright and writing for a specific actor. You know what that person can do, and so you sort of weight the piece in those ways. And so, you know, there's a certain range, of course, that I have, and the piece is going to come out the way ultimately, you know, the way I envision. But having her playing style, one of the things that I think struck me early on was her very fastidious characterization of inner rhythmic parts. So my music has a lot of polyrhythm. She would take one of those polyrhythms and really dress it up. And so I emphasize that in the piece a lot. And there's a playful joy in her playing that I emphasize in the piece. So the piece would have been completely different with a different performer.
And you and David Robertson and Orly have become close friends.
Exactly. Well, David has done a lot of my music. We met when he conducted me playing an electric guitar concerto that I wrote for myself at Aspen. And at that point, we sort of connected both musically and personally. And since then, he's done a lot of my music, and he's done a lot of my music here in St. Louis. And knowing that David and Orly together would be premiering the piece had an enormous impact on the composition of the piece. Just to give you one example, in the last movement, there are some long passages where Orly really has to go against what the conductor is doing. So Orly's part is in another kind of meter tempo than the orchestra. And normally in a typical situation when the soloist and the conductor meet for 1 hour before the first rehearsal, they wouldn't be able to iron out those kinks. It would be awkward. But knowing them and knowing that they're married and knowing that they're friends of mine, I knew that they would take the time to sort of iron that out at the first rehearsal. Already you could see that they had. There was no issue. And I don't think the orchestra realized what was really going on that went so smoothly.
It's interesting, this sense of composer and musician kind of matching DNAs or something to come up with this kind of hybrid that becomes their
well,
own.
Yeah. I think part of it is that I'm a performer myself. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think of the music in a vacuum, and I don't want it to just live in my head or on my desk. I want it to live on a stage. And in order to live on a stage in physical space, it requires interpreters. I mean, that's the great thing about music. It's, you know, different than visual art, certainly, where, you know, I paint the thing and there it is. But this really is a collaborative art.
Orly's been keeping up a great blog of The Concerto Is Born that people can look it up on orlyshaham.com. And you even were checking out how wide can Orly spread her fingers at the piano.
I have a big paw. I'm a lousy pianist, but I have a big hand. So it just occurred to me that things that might be natural for me would be unnatural for her, and I'm right. I mean, she doesn't stretch as far as I can stretch. So there were a few adjustments required.
Now, composers also have a life, and you are now a father. And the birth of your child is intimately related to this work. Even giving it its title, Stumble to Grace, would you talk about that inspiration and how it relates to the programmatic nature of the concerto?
First of all, my son, now 2.5 years old, Jasper, was born 2 months early. So the beginning of his life was very challenged. And actually, that's another way that David and Orly and I became friends. I mean, they were very supportive during the time my son was in the NICU, and they have twins a little bit older than my son, so we sort of bonded over that as well. So when thinking about a piece for David and Orly, since they personally are so tied up with my son and their children, that's part of what sparked this. And so over the course of writing this piece, I watched my son go from not being able to walk to, you know, being able to climb ladders and run around. And there's the title, Stumble to Grace, just sort of watching him stumble. And there's a way when children stumble that it's not like the drunk uncle at your wedding that's an embarrassment. I mean, you know, it's full of joy and exploration. So I'm trying to capture that aspect of stumble, which also fits into some pianistic influences of mine. One pianistic influence of mine is a Thelonious Monk, who sort of stumbles at the piano in a wonderfully, you know, inventive and playful way.
Plank, plunk.
Plunk, kerplunkety plink. Yeah, it sounds like strings are breaking on the piano. So my concerto begins in that sort of world. In fact, the orchestra starts playing a quarter tone flat from normal intonation so that when the pianist enters for the first time, it's as if the pianist is out of tune, to just really emphasize that idea of struggling to become human and struggling to fit in. Over the course of the piece, it goes through a lot of stages, and over the course of the piece, by the fifth stage, it's called, Orly has gone from kerplunkety-plink to playing a very elaborate contrapuntal music. I think it's even safe to call it a fugue, a, you know, very virtuosic triple fugue with parts inverting and jumping all over each other and very steady, fast, up-tempo. So she goes from literally playing with all thumbs, you know, one note at a time, to playing very elegant, sophisticated, and virtuosic music.
So she's really playing with her thumbs.
The first couple of notes, it's to be played all thumbs, you know, metaphorically. I mean, there's some things you can't do that way, but metaphorically and as much as possible literally. And she needs at least 10 fingers to play the end. The piece has that narrative arc from stumbling to this sort of graceful sophistication.
The early information we were getting about this work while it was in process was that there was some references to Mozart. Did those remain in there?
Well, Mozart in general and Mozart piano concertos in particular are absolutely favorite repertoire for me personally. And maybe I know that the piano concerto as a genre sort of has its golden age in the 19th century, late 19th century, and great virtuosi, Liszt and others. But that's not where my pianistic influences really lie. You know, sort of clarity and transparency of line and the color and the sort of brightness and the playfulness of Mozart piano concertos really were a big influence for me. And as I said, along with Thelonious Monk and Vince Guaraldi, the composer of the music for Peanuts. But everything I do is, I think, influenced by Mozart. The kind of easy flow from one idea to another is something that I aspire to. My music is very much about motion. You know, it's not about, you could maybe say a lot of composers are about the objects, you know, they're material at any one point in time. And my music is really more about the flow of things, the way things move. And I think Mozart is very much like that. You'll have, you know, two measures of a chorale followed by four measures of an Alberti bass and then a contrapuntal section. And it just flows so seamlessly. And that aspect is something that I hope is in Stumble to Grace.
Now, you just went through your first rehearsal of Stumble to Grace, the first ever. How did you survive it?
Well, it's always nerve-wracking. You know, you're writing the piece and you imagine, of course, the 50th performance. When you're composing, you don't imagine the first rehearsal, you know. Only as you enter the hall and sit down and get ready for the first rehearsal, do you realize, oh, yeah, this is not going to be the 50th performance. This is the first rehearsal, and I've done this many times, but I always forget to prepare myself. As first rehearsals go, this was really good. I mean, by the end of the rehearsal, I could really hear the piece come into shape. There's some unusual requests that I make of the orchestra that I would not have been surprised if I got some mild revolt, you know. But the orchestra is very generous and knowing and did the quirky things without having to be coached at all. I mean, I asked the harp to retune a little bit, retune a quarter tone. I asked some other, you know, sort of quarter tone things, some odd percussion instruments, and all those things were just there, you know. So what remained were, you know, some tricky rhythmic issues that they just have to play that, you know, and tomorrow we'll clear those up. But I was very pleased with the first rehearsal.
Are there still changes that might happen between Thursday afternoon and the first performance?
Well, at this point, there will be still changes. You know, the changes will get subtler and subtler. Tomorrow, there'll still be dynamic changes. Tomorrow, we'll still ask, you know, the tom-toms to change that forte to a mezzo forte and ask the violin to maybe play more on the string instead of so staccato and ask the flute to add a slur between these two notes. Little things like that will change. There was a major change coming in. I mean, only a week ago, I changed the end of the piece. It had a initially sort of big climactic moment that was interrupted and went straight into this kind of reflective epilogue. And when I met with David and Orly and heard Orly play her part and sort of talked it over with them, we all sort of came to the revelation that, you know what, I'm throwing away an opportunity because it really does sort of reach a really great place of excitement. And whatever was in my mind that wanted to sort of cut that off and not give the audience the sort of pleasure of just going out that way. So in the last week, I took 3-4 days and completely rewrote the ending and carried that energy through so that the audience would not feel repressed. And so Orly wouldn't feel repressed. I think it was the right move because the hard part is sort of getting to that place. It was another composer that thought, okay, let's squelch this and pour water on it.
You decided to go for it.
Yeah, I decided to go for it. Yeah, life's too short. Yeah.
Now, Stravinsky composed via piano, as many composers do and have, and your first instrument is the guitar, and specifically electric guitar. How does guitar inform your practice?
Well, the guitar influences everything I do, or the fact that I'm a guitarist influences everything I do. For one thing, just sort of the sound of an electric guitar, I think, gives me a certain predilection for certain kinds of colors in the orchestra. I often find myself sort of synthesizing the guitar in the orchestra, orchestrating in such a way that I guess the best way to describe it is that the orchestra sounds like it has some distortion, like an electric guitar has a distortion pedal. And I do think in terms of effects, like echo effects or distortion effects or chorusing effects or harmonizer effects, you know, different boxes that I stomp a pedal on to make my guitar change its tone of voice, you have to sort of hand make in the orchestra. But those things are in my ear. So I do find myself hand making these kind of effects for the orchestra. I'm sure there's lots of other influences, an approach to rhythm, kind of a muscular approach to rhythm. The electric guitar obviously is not indigenous to concert music. And so as an electric guitar player, you grow up playing, you know, kind of rhythmic, funky music. And so that kind of a sense of groove, as well as a sort of a sense of searing line in an electric guitar solo, a Jimi Hendrix solo, something like that, this searing line, those things absolutely influence my work as well.
Are there any 70s wah-wah in this?
Yeah. Wah-wah is something that's really hard to synthesize with the orchestra, but no, yeah.
Would you work on it?
Yeah, I will work on it. I'm afraid people might, you know, think it's a B-movie.
You've developed a strong relationship with the St. Louis Symphony since David Robertson became music director. Your violin concerto, Beautiful Passing, has been performed twice by Lila Joseph-Witz and Anthony Marwood. Turn the Key was performed a couple years ago with Gilbert Varga conducting. What did David Robertson and the St. Louis Symphony bring to new music that may be different from other conductors and ensembles?
Well, David's the best. I mean, you really learn about a conductor when you play under them. And as I said, David and I met when I was a soloist in my own electric guitar concerto. And in that moment, I felt, as I took more time or pushed ahead, and for a variety of reasons, mainly sort of the music festival scheduling, which is very tight, David and I had little time to talk, and we had very little rehearsal time. But in the moment of performance, as I got swept away and I'd push ahead or pull back, David was right there without any discussion. He had the orchestra right there. So A, he was listening and had my back, and B, he had complete control of the orchestra. And he just has a basic, strong sense of rhythm, which, believe it or not, a lot of conductors don't have. You know, conductors often can be very sort of graceful in their movements, but that doesn't translate to a crisp rhythmic sense. And David has both, and it's really crisp. And for my music, it's essential. And I think that sort of engenders a certain amount of trust from the orchestra. They know they're on the same side. It's not about David doing a dance. It's about David trying to do the best performance and doing what they need. And what they need is a crisp rhythmic sense. And so there's a certain trust and certain understanding. So when the composer shows up, in other situations, when the orchestra is kind of feeling on edge and insecure, and here's the composer, and he's asking to do these things that are challenging and you know, unusual, and why, you know, why would you want to do that? You come to St. Louis, and the orchestra is very generous and very understanding. I don't know, there's a variety of reasons for that. Just maybe in the hiring process, they know they're going to do a lot of contemporary music, and they look for someone who's open to that. But I think also once here, there's this community set up of, you know, like I said, trust in the conductor, trust in each other, and that relaxes everybody and allows them to go for it and not be uptight about making a mistake.